Hello and welcome to The Reset, a mental health podcast without all the bollocks. I'm Sam Delaney. My guest this week is the Dutch writer Dan Herman van Vos. Dan is an award-winning literary novelist who's now turned his hand to non-fiction with a new book called The Anxiety Project. In it, he writes with brutal honesty and massive self-awareness about his anxiety condition, which has plagued him all his life. Not only does he explore his personal background, his genetic makeup, and the effects of his conditions on his love life and friendships, but he also investigates a history of anxiety treatment and how the economic and social landscape in the modern Western world might be contributing to an anxiety epidemic. He's a great bloke who also happens to be an avid Ajax fan, something I spent a huge amount of time talking to him before we recorded this episode. Anyway, that's by the by. This is a really interesting chat, I think, with a very clever bloke. I hope you enjoy listening to it. Dan, welcome to The Reset.
Thank you.
This book is a remarkable achievement. Was it chiefly a cathartic process for you? Was that why you first embarked upon it?
Well, I was hoping for that because the beginning of the book, well, is very, the beginning of this whole journey, I see it as a journey, the book, was very autobiographical. My then girlfriend sort of forcing me to finally look the monster in the eye and find out what these fears were, this anxiety was that was holding me in its grip, and so also her and us in its grip. So I was hoping for that, but it wasn't my primary goal. I don't think I am a fiction writer in generally, I'm a fiction writer. So I don't see a book or any book project as being therapeutical in essence. It shouldn't be that. You have therapy for that. But every book you write is also therapeutical. So it wasn't a goal, I was hoping for it. My goal was just to find out what had been plaguing me for all these years. And we don't, I mean, a lot has been written about anxiety from neurologists, psychologists, a few historians, but they all present such a fragmented way of looking at fear and anxiety. That didn't help me. So I wanted a book that was, well, you could say an easy read, or at least a very personal read, a personal book that also encompasses all those fields of expertise. So I wanted a book that was all of the above, but it doesn't read as being heavy. So I wanted to write something that didn't exist. The book I wanted to read, but it was not there. And of course, I didn't really know where I would wind up, because it's such a broad field: anxiety, fear. Where do you begin? So it was very much a journey into the unknown of myself, because I didn't want to face all these fears, and also in all these fields of expertise, I didn't know that well.
Let's go back to the sort of incident that, at least in the book, serves as a catalyst to your journey of discovery, which is, like you say, a conversation with your then girlfriend. This was something that felt very, I could relatable to me, and I'm sure lots of other people who read it, that feeling that you almost feel like you've lost all control over your own thoughts, and you can see that it's starting to affect the person who you love and who loves you. And therefore these thoughts, these fears, many of which might have been imaginary, start to actually create a genuine threat, which is a threat to your relationship. And it's as if your girlfriend's saying to you, I just can't take this anymore.
And yeah, I found that chilling because I had a, you know, when I have been in the depths of my mental health problems, there was a moment where I remember the first time offloading to my girlfriend, to my wife, really offloading to her because I didn't know what else I could do. I couldn't keep in any longer. And she'd been very understanding up until the point. And then one day she just started to weep. And I, you know, you use a beautiful phrase in the book, which is slow tears. And I just thought to myself, oh no, this could actually jeopardize my relationship. How painful was that? And had it had the same thing happened in previous relationships? Is this, was your anxiety always getting in the way of things like that?
It was heartbreaking because when you're struggling with these kind of deep anxieties which are so profound and so constant that they put you in a state of depression and you can't really get out, you're in a state of survival. So you're constant, each day you're surviving just to get through the day. But you being preoccupied with surviving is perceived by the other, the significant other, as a process of withdrawal. Your surviving is, in a way, not committing to her and the relationship. So it's very painful to hear because I was thinking, I'm doing everything I can just to keep it all together. And exactly that process was being too much for her. And I understood it. I knew it, that was going on. I had known that for a few months. I was hoping that she would not say those words or cry those tears, because I knew it would, I could sort of shelve it or say that it wasn't, deny it, as long as she hadn't really said it. But there they were, those words, and I knew she was right. And in previous relationships, it had been a problem as well. This moment always arose, sooner or later. As soon as a woman I fall for, or a woman I love, gets to know me, I sort of dreaded, things have changed a bit, but dreaded the day that she would find out the other side of me, or the real me, as I thought back then. In every relationship, this conversation arose sooner or later. But this time, my answer was always, okay, yeah, I'll try to fix it. And then I did some therapy or took some antidepressants. And as soon as I sort of got out of that well or that pit, I could say to myself, well, it's done now, I'm better now. But in my heart, I knew that I hadn't resolved anything. So this time, when this girlfriend was crying and said those words, this was a different kind of relationship. We were living together. We were together for 5 years by then. So this was the moment for me to take the other way and actually face whatever it was there was I had to face. And I did that by the only means I know, which is being honest, taking notes, and writing.
Yeah. So you obviously decided that you needed to, that a point had come where you could no longer just sort of practice maintenance.
No, it wasn't tenable.
You had to deep dive into it and get down to the roots of it, which is interesting because some people do think, well, there's nothing to understand. This is a condition, like some people would say, you know, like I've been to my GP, my doctor before, and when I in the early days of me confronting my problems, and they say, oh, well, you know, it's just like you don't catch a cold or get a sore throat and need to know exactly how the viral infection came about. You just need to know how you can get better and live with it, right? I don't necessarily agree with that. But some people just think you don't need to understand it. You just need to learn how to live with it. But you decided that you had to truly, deeply understand it on the detailed level in order to then start to unpick it. Is that right?
Yeah, well, you could say you could decide that it's not about understanding your anxiety.
Mm.
And sort of that's more of a Buddhist, Taoist approach. But then it has to be a choice. It has to be a position you come to.
Mm.
It wasn't a position of mine. I just didn't have any idea. So if at the end of this whole process of getting to know what anxiety and fear is, I would then, that would result in my taking the position, me taking the position, well, all this isn't important. I'll just take it day by day and not think about it. That would be justifiable. That's fine. But that was not where I was. And also, I think this analogy of the doctor is kind of preposterous, because the thing about fear is, and do you mind, what kind of word do you like me to use? Fear or anxiety?
Either's fine. Either's fine with me. Whatever feels right to you.
Do they mean the same thing to you?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Then I'll just say anxiety. Anxiety has always been closely connected to your imagination and your thoughts. So you can't just say it's a physical phenomenon, like, say, a cold. Cold isn't connected with your fantasies and your expectations of the future and your thoughts about what will happen to you if those expectations aren't met. There's no psyche involved with a cold. So I think that's a very limiting view that does not really help you that much. If it helps you to not sort of take the deep dive and just do it day by day, that's fine. But for me, that was exactly what was holding me back, because I always had this cycle of a very anxious period and then getting out of that and forgetting about it. That's also a thing people who are inclined to have depressions do. They have a very strange relationship with their memory. They sort of forget all their depressed periods as soon as they're over. That's a survival mechanism, because if you remember every depression, you will probably lack the courage to go on. So as soon as you're out, you sort of shove that aside and forget all about it. So that was my strategy as well. As soon as I was out, I forgot all about it. But that made it a cyclical thing. And yeah, that whole cycle was slowly wrecking my life, really. So I had to take the other route.
Yeah, I can relate to that myself. And it's something that I've discussed with a lot of other male friends and people who've come on this pod. In fact, that cycle whereby you feel like you've addressed it, you've got better, and
yeah,
and then you kind of think, well, that's that fixed. I don't have to think about that.
Let's not dwell on that.
Yeah. And it always comes back. I remember my first ever therapist, when I stopped going to see him after like seeing him for like maybe a 3 month period, and I just stopped booking him, and he started leaving messages for me and I ignored them. And at the time, I told myself I wasn't in a good place at all. And I told myself that he was trying to hustle me. But I remember specifically him saying to me, Sam, you have to understand, I know you might be thinking that you're through this now, but if you don't complete what we've started, it will come back. It will definitely come back. And I remember scoffing, like when I was listening to his voicemail, thinking, he just wants me to carry on paying him money. Yeah. And I mean, that was many years ago, and I've been in long-term therapy since then, but I often think about his words and think he was absolutely right, but I couldn't see it at that time in my life.
Never say that. Tell him that afterwards, like later.
Yeah, I haven't been in touch with him for years and years, because he did subsequently, years later, when I got more committed to therapy and recovery and whatnot, after terrible times that he had warned me about, I got a new therapist, and I've been with her for 8 years. But maybe I should look him up one of these days and tell him that he played a part in me kind of slowly getting better. Yeah, yeah.
But you do recognize this cycle.
I do, yeah. When you, I mean, you phrase it really well, and I recognize it. And I don't like to talk a lot about meds on this podcast, because obviously I'm not an expert, but you see it in the way in which people often will go to a doctor, get prescribed antidepressants, do it for a period, feel better, come off the antidepressants. And of course, as most of us have experienced, if you've taken those drugs, getting on them is actually often more difficult than getting off them. You know, the period for a lot of us when you first start taking them can be very difficult before they start to take effect. And you know, and I've been through it myself, and I know other people over there. You think you're better, you come off the medication, you bounce back again, maybe a few months later or a year later or a couple of years later, and you have to go through the whole thing of going back on. And that's a cycle in itself that can be very, very, I mean, it puts you through a lot, that cycle, you know.
Yeah. It does.
In quite a real and practical way. I want to just for the listeners' benefit, for you to tell us about the means by which I believe it was a research study or laboratory in Amsterdam tested your hair and concluded that you may be, and I know you probably say this with your tongue in cheek, you may be the world's most anxious man. Can you explain to us how you discovered that?
Yeah, well, the way they cortisol is considered to be the anxiety hormone or the stress hormone. It's one of those hormones you produce when you are in fight or freeze mode. So someone who's very anxious has very high levels of cortisol. When you have very high levels of cortisol, you must be anxious. That's the connection. The way they find out how much cortisol you have in your blood is by examining your hair. Every centimeter of your hair is a month in time, in length. So you can send a few hairs to the laboratory, and then you can see how your cortisol has developed in those months. People don't really do that very often. But I was very curious, because I had this sense that I was dealing with anxiety and fear all the time, but I didn't have any, you know, proof. So I sent them to the lab twice, actually. And well, the first time, I think you I don't have the book here with me. You can look it up.
I think the context was the average amount of cortisol in a head for someone from your part of the world would have been, I think it was like, I've got 2%.
Yeah, 2%, one, was it? I think it 1.7. Yeah.
2.7 picograms of cortisol per milligram of hair. And in people who are very suffer from very long term mental health problems, it can be as high as 15 picograms. But for you, in the first month, it was 74. Then it was 87. And then eventually your reading was as high as 200.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, it was absolutely ridiculous. And so the doctor didn't really believe the results, but we tested it three times, and each time she sent a few hairs of her own to the lab, and they came out normal. So there was no way that could have gone wrong, really. But there was also no way to actually believe the results, because it was so absurdly off the charts that there was no model for this. So she couldn't accept it, but also couldn't offer an alternative theory. She came up with this theory that I might have some sort of tumor that produces cortisol, but I knew that was, I don't have that. I don't have any symptoms except that. So it was, I actually felt quite vindicated.
That was what I was going to say. Did you feel, when they told you that you were effectively 100 times more anxious than the average person, did you...
I was actually quite proud.
Yeah, and did you think, yeah, that sounds about right?
Well, I was very proud of myself that I didn't mess up my life 100 times worse than other people do.
Yeah.
I mean, I do mess it up slightly more than the average person, maybe, but not that much. No, I was actually quite proud that I could, that I was functioning with that. So it was such a ridiculous number that I didn't really know how to respond. But I believed it, of course. Mm. Yeah. No, I always had the feeling that my perception of reality was fundamentally different than that of those around me. So it's, and cortisol does that. So I felt this could be right. And also it was a very bad period. So I don't think that the results today would be as bad as then. So, yeah. No, I might be.
Can we get just a sense of, you know, what your anxiety looked like? You know, you describe it as being, you know, completely incessant. Was there any particular theme to your worries and fears, or was it anything and everything when you go through one of these phases?
It has to be with, it has to do with my mental resilience. If I'm in a healthy period, I do sleep enough, there's not that much stress, I'm fine, I'm not that anxious. But if the burden or the load becomes more than I can handle and I don't sleep, when there's always this tipping point, and if I cross that tipping point, everything can become frightening. So there aren't, I mean, the basic fear, I guess, would be that I'm not strong enough for this life. I'm right. Not up to the task.
Yeah.
So when a few things go wrong, I would crumble and I wouldn't have the strength to build myself up again.
Mm.
So that's, on the one hand, very daunting. On the other hand, it's terribly vague. And that vagueness is can be quite problematic, because it allows that fear to shapeshift. So it can turn into, it can take the form of, if that book doesn't really work,
mm.
your life is over.
Yeah.
It can shapeshift into a different anxiety if your wife or your girlfriend leaves you, there will be nothing left, and you are not up to it.
Mm.
So because of that vagueness, it's morphs into all these kinds of specific fears. Well, fears that feel very specific, but actually don't have anything to do with the circumstances. And then, of course, my reaction always has been the wrong one, namely trying to think a way out of it.
Yeah.
So my response to anxiety has always been obsession.
Yeah.
And then you're spiraling.
Yeah. That's really familiar to me as well. Like in my worst times, it was always because I would, you know, like when a car's skidding, they say you should steer into it. But if you try to steer out of the skid, the car will spin, won't it? And that's how I always thought of my anxiety is I'd think, oh, it's fine. I can lie. If I was lying awake at night, I'd start working out, trying to unlock it all like a puzzle, thinking that I could eventually arrive at a point where I'd fixed it. But of course, that just circulates the worrying thoughts more and more around your mind, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is exhausting, and it that's a very interesting phenomenon. It makes you smaller. Each obsessive thought you have makes you smaller because it's a way of signaling to yourself, I need this thought. I need this scenario. Without this, I will crumble. If A doesn't work, there will be B. But what you're telling yourself is, I need B. So with every obsessive thought, you sort of give away autonomy, sovereignty to these thoughts that will never materialize. So you're putting yourself in small pieces with every obsessive thought you have. So what you think that's what's keeping me safe, but that's, on the contrary, is what making you, it's ripping you apart. And in the end, you think, I need these thoughts. So you become addicted to it. And then the thoughts become the problem. So you're skidding. Yeah.
So you go on this journey to look at the big questions surrounding the roots of not just your anxiety, but the world's anxiety, because as you observe in the book, you know, this is a growing problem across the globe. I'm going to go through some of the areas that you investigate. Chiefly, where is it coming from? You look at, you know, what genes have to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much of this is hardwired into us? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, when it comes to the ancient nature nurture debate, I always considered myself to be a nurture type of person. But I have to say, when looking at the evidence and looking at the studies and the academic literature, it does turn out that nature plays a big part. When you look at studies that have been done with twins or adoptions, those you can sort of see whether twins that have been separated at birth develop similar proneness to anxiety. And they do generally. So there is this genetic component to susceptibility to anxiety. It doesn't have to turn out that way. Their life events make a big difference too, but whether you're prone or susceptible to anxiety is indeed hardwired. It same thing with my family. It turns out I didn't know that when I started out writing the book, but my mother had been very anxious, same fears as I had. Her mother had them, so my grandmother, and even her father had them. So we also in my family there's this heritage. We sort of pass each other. There's this big genetic component. There's no No two ways about that. A different thing. I mean, trauma is a different thing. Someone who's not genetically susceptible to anxiety can suffer such trauma that a whole new cycle begins.
Mm.
I would say, and I was surprised by that because I was very ready to blame it all on nurture. But
did it help you personally at all to come to understand that?
Yeah, it did. It did, because I always felt like an outlier, like a freak in the family.
Mm.
So it did sort of secure a place for me in the family narrative, and it made me slightly milder towards myself, not blaming myself the way I did before. And it raised all sorts of new interesting questions about the labels we attach to these symptoms, these complaints, because well, in our age it's the anxiety disorder, but my mother had this weird, she was living in Freudian time, so she had this weird Freudian label attached to herself. Then my grandmother, it was called depression, and then her father, it was called melancholy. So you have all these exactly the same symptoms, like basically being able to function at a high level, but as soon as you're overwhelmed, you sort of collapse and everything becomes a source of anxiety. They all had that, but it was, the diagnosis each time was entirely different. So what does that tell you about the status of today's label? I hadn't really thought about that before, but it, of course, it makes it fundamentally relative. And that was very interesting to start.
What's interesting, though, is that if you look back at those other sort of eras, right, or the different ways in which it was analyzed through the generations, you're right, it always changed. Our perception of it, our analysis, our description of it changed, but the symptoms were basically the same. So, yeah, it may well evolve once more. It probably will. But we are now discussing and examining this more as a society than ever before, aren't we? Is that right to say? I mean, I feel as if you go back to your grandfather's era, in which it might have been called melancholy, or your great-grandfather's era, that it was like not something that was widely discussed across society.
Well, as I've found, every age has been called the age of anxiety. So we have always been fearful that something was happening to our society. Like the whole start of modernism with trains coming into to the countryside, into the cities, and the big urbanization movements around the 1900s, people were terrified that this would be the end of our mental or normalcy, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So even that way of thinking and being afraid of that is not new. That's one part of the answer. And the other part is that in the few meta studies that have been tried to find out whether we have become more anxious, and those are very complicated studies because how do you measure that? It does seem to point to that people who were growing up in the 1980s have elevated levels of anxiety. Yeah. And with the generation that grow up with their cell phone, there's a new spike. So we don't know yet how that evolves, but it probably won't be good.
And there's that, and there is also what people call, a lot of people call it the end stage capitalism. What role did you conclude is that, is the economic climate and political climate we live in today having an effect on anxiety?
Well, I think it does. I think it does, because we're from the generation that growing up, we learned that everything was malleable. We could become the person we wanted to be. Everything was possible. So we learned that it was okay or even desirable to have great expectations. But then the reality was, of course, that the whole system is rigged. Those expectations we have can't be met. So we're from the generation, and the generations after us have different kind of problems, but the same in that sense that we know that the future is getting worse, smaller, ecologically very turbulent. So we are the first generations that see that the future will not nearly be as bright as our present. So that's a whole new sensibility we're just learning to accept these days. So that does make a great difference. And also capitalism has terrible consequences for the way we look after each other, that for the way that we used to come together in times of adversity, and now we're all atomized, we're separated. There's no sense of solidarity anymore. I mean, that's a direct result of capitalism. I mean, Thatcher even said that society wasn't even a thing. So capitalism has played a very important role in accelerating this anxious state of mind so many of us are having right now. How do you feel about that?
I agree. It's a theme that comes up, you know, from time to time on this podcast. And I think that, you know, people, of course, have been living under this economic system for over a century at least. But I feel that the stage it's at now, like you say, the curtain has been drawn back a bit. And like it's been easier, it becomes easier with each passing day for us to see some of the myths. And I suppose our parents, as long as they were, you know, getting on in their careers and being able to afford to buy a house and so on and so forth, and raising kids who were more, who had a better life than they had before them, then I guess that's a narrative that is, you know, working. It makes you think, oh, this is working.
Progress, yeah.
But all of those things are now in reverse quite vividly. And so it's very hard to wake up feeling optimistic. You know, whether you're someone who is genetically predisposed to anxiety or not, optimism, especially if you're a young person, is a hard thing to come by these days.
Very much so.
So, you know, I suppose lastly, I want to ask you, you know, you're a novelist, really. This is your first nonfiction work. So, you know, you are a creative person. Did you discover that anxiety, your anxiety had played a positive role in your creativity to any extent? Is there anything to be grateful for by having an anxious mind?
There is. I'm of course, I can't prove this academically, not in a real sense, but I have found also in literature that the anxious mind is always connected to sensitivity And that can also mean you're very sensitive about the wonderful parts of life. When you're very anxious, you have these moments that you feel deeply connected to other human beings, a sense of belonging when the anxiety dims somewhat, fades somewhat. You are probably more in tune with feeling grateful when you're feeling good. Anxiety is also connected to empathy. When you're anxious, you're very attuned to how other people are feeling. When you see someone else struggling, you probably will notice that. So anxiety, in a way, allows you to become a better friend or a better companion. And now I'm talking, of course, about periods in which during which the anxiety or the fear is manageable, where you're doing okay. When you're in survival mode, you can't really be bothered with other people because there's not enough space for you to do so. But generally, I would say empathy and anxiety are linked as well. And as I said before, earlier in our conversation, there's also a correlation between anxiety and imagination. And that can work against you. When you're in an anxious state of mind, you tend to imagine all these negative outcomes and catastrophic scenarios, so it can work against you, but that same imagination can produce wonderful thoughts as well, and creative thoughts that a less agile mind wouldn't be able to conjure up, I would say. So it's a mistake to see anxiety as a sort of separate apart from the rest of you. It's not like a limb. It's not like an organ you can rip out. It's woven into your being. So you can't really separate it from who you are. So the other side of the coin can be quite beautiful. Everything that is beautiful or worthwhile, or everything I live for because of the connection I'm allowed to feel with it by anxiety, I would say.
That's amazing. It's an amazing thought. And it's, as is evident throughout your book, it's a fascinating and wide ranging and forensic way of looking at anxiety and the role it plays in our world and our lives. And for that reason, I'd encourage anyone listening who recognises any of these things we've been discussing today to pick up a copy of The Anxiety Project, A Journey to the Centre of Our Deepest Fears. Dan, it's been a pleasure and an education speaking with you. I'm very grateful for your time. And the book is wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
There you go. Dan Herman Van Vos, author of brilliant new book, The Anxiety Project. It's intelligent but readable, and I highly recommend it. Thanks for listening, as always, gang. Please remember to subscribe to The Reset at samdelaney.substack.com for bonus pods, live events, newsletters, and participation in our little community talking about mental health without all the bollocks. Until next time, gang, be lucky and don't let the dickheads get you down.